Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C. This is Agriculture Today.
Planted, we were down 25.6% at the 10.2 million acres from the previous year.
Acting chief for the crops branch of the National Ag Statistics Service, Chris Hawthorne.
Harvested also is up 9.8% over last year. Our yield is at 765 pounds per acre. That's down 2.3% from our previous forecast and down 19.5% from the previous year. Production at 12.7 million bales was down 2.4% from the previous forecast and down 11.7% from the previous year. So we got some drought going on in some areas, and that's really dragging that down.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
Global wheat production.
World Ag Outlook Board Chairman Mark Jackanowski on Friday with the World Ag Supply Demand Estimates Report.
Going back to the back year real quick, kind of truing up some late date estimates, increase in Australia's crop that's based on ABARES data recently released. And then not listed in that list of countries, but notable for the back year is a reduction in Afghanistan's production by 700,000. And that's based on government data, based on their yearbook as well. Out year, current year, increase in Australia, 1 million tons. Again, this is government data. Canada up as well. So that would add to 2 million tons. But again, not listed in that chart is a offsetting reduction in Brazil by 1 million tons. That's based on Conabi data.
Jackanowski also looks at the corn numbers.
Essentially, all we what we're looking here at here is truing up to recent data, government data. Primarily, Mexico reduced 1 million tons. That's an area change based on government data. Lower harvested area there. The rest of those changes are basically harvest results. Worth noting the fairly large increases for Ukraine and Russia based on harvest results. Higher yields there. Good weather supporting those crops. Global balance sheet coming in with a little bit higher ending beginning stocks this month. That is mainly reflecting some back year adjustments in the Mexico carry-in by Mexico and Ukraine. So what else worth noting here? Feed use higher. That is primarily reflecting larger crops in Russia and the EU, so greater feed use there. Also higher feed use in Egypt and a handful of other countries contributing to that as well.
And what about soybeans in the latest WASDE report?
Global soybean production put up the back year, 2022-2023, here as well, because it's worth noting that we increased our Brazil production forecast. Again, this is for the back year. You might recall we did the same thing last month as well, just reflecting the fact that given the pace of their exports and that crop, it's turned out to be bigger than we expected. So we made this 2 million ton adjustment this month. Similarly, we made that adjustment last month as well. So that that big crop keeps getting bigger. And now for the out year, new crop year, we'll talk a little bit more about Brazil. We reduced our production forecast 2 million tons there this month, still up year over year. And then Canada's production was increased 300,000 tons based on government reports. One country not listed there, but worth noting, Russia soybean production was also increased based on government data.
And finally, on cotton.
Global cotton production, a couple changes here worth noting. Of course, the big change is in the U.S., which we'll talk about shortly, tightening up supplies in the U.S., but also lower production in Turkey. That's based on a post report. And Pakistan up a bit, offsetting some of that decline in Turkey. And that is based on arrivals data, coming in strong. So that crop is turning out to be a little bit bigger than previously anticipated.
Mark Jackanowski with USDA. It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
Every time Republicans run for office, we make a lot of promises about things like cutting spending, shrinking the bureaucracy, or securing the border. That's what you do when you run for office. You make a lot of promises. You make a lot of pledges. But we don't have the luxury of grading ourselves on our intention.
Chip Roy is a representative from Texas, a Republican on the House floor.
The road to hell is paved with good intentions. The American people, the history books, the good Lord are going to judge based on the actions we take and the results we deliver and whether or not we deliver for the American people. And to deliver for the American people, Republicans must force the Senate Democratic leadership, Majority Leader Schumer, President Biden, to understand a handful of very key truths. That under no circumstances should we give another dollar to Ukraine. No bill should come to the House floor until H.R. 2 is signed by the president and the flow stops across our southern border. That ought to be the very clear message that is sent to the president and Majority Leader Schumer. And if my colleagues on the other side of the aisle in the Senate want to choose to refuse to secure the border, then they can call up Mr. Zelensky and the people of Ukraine and explain why. That it's more important to keep open borders in America and undermine our sovereignty and our security and our well-being. Just like they can call up Israel and explain to Israel that they refuse to actually fund support for Israel because they're more interested in funding Internal Revenue Service bureaucrats to go after the American people. Because that's what our Democratic colleagues in the Senate have chosen to do. And they know it. They know it. We pass a bipartisan bill that chooses to move dollars that were allocated to expand the IRS to go after the American people, take those dollars, give it to our friends from Israel, and our Democratic colleagues in the Senate on a party line vote voted no. They refused to fund our friends in Israel because they were more committed to the leftist makeover of this country. They are more committed to open borders than they are to securing the communities of the American people and allowing us to have a full and open debate about Ukraine and how we can proceed to fund our government.
He says the Senate is broken down.
I understand the difficulty of dealing with a razor-thin majority with colleagues on the other side of the aisle who have no interest in doing the things that we want to do to secure the United States, secure our border, reduce spending, reduce inflation, focus the military on what it needs to be focused on, and to do our job under the Constitution and our limited powers. I understand the difficulty of that. We've done a great job when we've been united as a Republican Party to send good bills over to the Senate. Now we should hold the Senate accountable to doing the work of the American people, to follow up on what we've already done, to send a border security bill, H.R. 2, that would do the job of securing the border, sending a national defense authorization bill that would restore our military to its mission rather than social engineering, 7 appropriations bills and others that are ready to go if our colleagues on the other side of the Capitol in the Senate, our Democratic colleagues in the Senate, will sit down with us to actually reduce spending year over year from 2023 to 2024 so we can constrain spending, constrain inflation, constrain the bureaucrats that are interfering with the lives of the American people and undermining their freedom and their ability to produce and prosper according to their God-given talents. But voters are watching what we're doing. They're watching whether we're going to stand up and actually do our job and whether or not we're going to deliver for them rather than engaging in lip service. I think we need to do our job.
Speaking of razor-thin majorities, that's what the Republicans will have after the first of the year when the Farm Bill finally comes up for debate. It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
I would like to thank Chairman Thompson very much for being engaged with everyone from members of Congress to, most importantly, the farmers as we look at this Farm Bill.
Representative Michelle Fischbach from Minnesota speaking in front of the House Ag Committee last week during Member Day.
As many of you know, rural communities across the country are struggling to retain population, much less attract future generations. This is often because these areas either lack or have outdated basic community infrastructure like hospitals, child care centers, and senior care centers. Unnecessary regulatory barriers create a disincentive to providing the necessary capital resources to build these important pieces of our communities. Earlier this year, I introduced the Investing in Rural America Act, which encourages investment in rural communities by restoring and codifying farm credits eligibility to finance community facilities in partnership with local lenders and USDA's Community Facilities Loan Program. I encourage the committee to include this important legislation that helps build strong rural communities in the upcoming Farm Bill. I'd also like to talk briefly about crop insurance. I know this committee strongly supports the current crop insurance program, but I believe there's an important issue and opportunity in the upcoming Farm Bill to address. We spend billions on disaster assistance, not offset, outside the Farm Bill to compensate farmers for disasters. Congress has relied on inefficient, deficit-inducing, ad hoc assistance for both insurable and uninsurable disaster events. These programs are created and administered after the fact with often confusing and burdensome programs and leave producers waiting for assistance for years in some cases, while also driving up costs to the taxpayer. Look no further than the most recent iteration of ERP to see the flaws in the current system. Crop insurance has proven to be a bedrock risk management tool, and while I appreciate the fiscal constraints on this committee, I firmly believe an opportunity exists to build on the program's success by making higher coverage levels more affordable to producers across the country. This will help alleviate the need for ad hoc assistance programs, saving money while strengthening this important risk management tool. In many ways, this was the reason for the creation of the Federal Crop Insurance Program. Building these resources into the crop insurance program will help provide timely assistance, require producer skin in the game, and provide the consistency and certainty that the ad hoc system currently lacks. Finally, Mr. Chairman, Western Minnesota produces a third of the country's sugar beets, more than any other district or state in the country. Farmers in my district rely on the sugar program to provide nature sweetener to our tables. The industry contributes more than $23 billion each year for the U.S. economy, according to the Sugar Alliance. It is a job creator and a community driver at zero cost to taxpayers. I strongly urge the committee to reject misguided and harmful attacks on this program and protect it for the next generation of sugar beet and cane farmers across the country and especially in western Minnesota.
Chairman of the Natural Resources Committee from Arkansas is Bruce Westerman, a forester.
Another critical tool in confronting our forest health and wildlife crisis is a good neighbor authority. While state GNA projects have flourished, tribes and counties have not been given the same authority that states have to retain timber receipts for use on additional conservation and restoration work. This removes a significant incentive to partner on these projects. My colleagues on the Natural Resources Committee, led by Representative Fulcher, introduced legislation, the Treating Tribes and Counties as Good Neighbor Authority Act, is a bipartisan effort that allows tribes and counties to participate in the Good Neighbor Authority Program. This passed the House, and I urge you to prioritize it in the upcoming Farm Bill reauthorization.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
25 million bushels taken out of both corn and wheat on this report. And both of those were bumps to exports.
Greg McBride is director of brokerage with Allendale.
So we saw nice exports. We've seen better exports out of all three of the major grains, corn, beans, and wheat here recently. So the USDA doesn't typically make a lot of changes in the December report. They save those for the January report. So the fact that we saw just exports affected here is interesting, but not surprising, because a lot of times they'll save some of those production number changes until we get to that January timeframe when we get the four major reports at the same time. So that'll be something to watch. This was a little bit friendly on the corn side and the wheat side for the USDA WASDE numbers, the grain ending stocks numbers, seeing them down 25 million bushels. But the problem I still have with this corn market is at 2.131 billion bushels for ending stocks, that is still burdensome. That is still a little bit too much. In order to justify the price that we've got, we need to be closer to about, say, 1.7 or 1.8 billion. So we need to see a major cut here just to be able to justify the price that we're at, sub $5.
But when looking at the latest World Ag Supply Demand Estimates or WASDE report, any surprises for soybeans?
We didn't think we were going to see any changes to the ending stocks for the U.S. for soybeans. We didn't get any changes, so nothing extravagant there. We did think potentially we were going to see a minor increase in Argentina's crop, and I still think that might be coming eventually. So they're on a rebound after their drought year last year, essentially the last two or three years. But they're back at 48 million tons. That was expected to go up about 200,000 tons. I wouldn't be surprised if we're somewhere closer to 50 by the time they get to harvest. Well, it'd be next spring for us. On the other hand, the Brazil crop is going the other way. With all the dryness to start out this this growing season and their planting season, we were looking at a monster crop, 163 to almost one. You know, there were some areas that were like 168 as far as private analysts looking for their overall production. We're looking at right now the USDA saying they took off 2 million tons. They're at 161 million. And that's still a little bit higher than what some of the private analysts here in the U.S. were saying. You were anywhere from about 2.8 million tons lower to about 3.5 million tons lower. I'm kind of in that camp that I think that number is going to continue to come down a little bit. But right now, it's tough for the USDA to make that assumption because the prime time, the biggest time for yield determination and production for that bean crop in Brazil is going to be in that first 2 weeks of January. So until we get to, let's say, until we get into about maybe the 15th to the 20th of December, we aren't even going to get forecasts that give us an idea of what that first couple of weeks of January look like. So for right now, we can't really get too excited about it. The USDA has recognized a potential problem, but they aren't willing to really overstep at this point with the idea that if the rains do show up, they may have to go the other way. I still do think that we're going to see that number come down a little bit, but we won't truly know for about 3 to 5 weeks before we can really make that that judgment.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
What we've done today opens ourselves up to having persons expelled for things that a good many people are not going to agree with.
Texas Democratic Representative Al Green on the floor of the House last week after the House voted to expel Republican George Santos from New York.
Let me explain. To expel a person without a bifurcated system, in my opinion, is a mistake. Impeachment has a bifurcated system. The House indicts by way of impeaching, and then after impeaching, the Senate has the trial to convict or not. Impeachment itself is not bifurcated. The process to remove the president from office is bifurcated. But impeachment is one part of that process. That is the function of the House. The process then provides that if you want to continue and remove, you have to get the consent of the Senate. That's a bifurcated process to remove a president from office. I think we ought to have a bifurcated process, notwithstanding our right not to. I think we ought to have a bifurcated process to remove a person from Congress. There is only one way for a person to get to the Congress of the United States of America, unlike the Senate, where you can get appointed. With the Congress, you have to be voted on by the people. That's why this is the people's house. This house belongs to the people of the United States of America, and membership herein belongs to the people of the United States of America. Yet, in the infinite wisdom of those who were the codifiers and writers of the Constitution, they have given us the authority to remove people. We can do it. I just happen to disagree with the way we're doing it, because by doing it this way, without having the actual House of Representatives give some deference to the judicial system, we now no longer have another party in the process. We, in fact, now have become the investigators, the judges, the jury, and the prosecutors. We have every right to do that. I don't quarrel with anyone who would say to me as a retort, well, we have the right to do it. We have every right to do it. The question is, should we do this? I don't think so. I think it was a mistake. I think that in at some point in the future, we're going to see the error of our ways. This decision is going to haunt us. You cannot appeal a decision of the House of Representatives, which is why we ought to have the judicial system involved. If a person commits a crime, that is brought to our attention. There's a conviction, comes from the judiciary. We then act on that conviction. We have now a second party, involved in the process such that that party can deliberate and make a decision without the House of Representatives having influenced that decision. I think that's a fair way to remove people from the House of Representatives. I don't think that we should do it with the House being the investigators, the judge, the jury, prosecutor.
Now, in 2024, the Republicans will have just a one-seat majority. That after former Speaker of the House Kevin McCarthy announced he'll leave Congress at the end of the year. Plus, Ohio Representative Bill Johnson will step down before the end of March to become president of Youngstown State University. It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
Agriculture and Arkansas are synonymous.
Bruce Westerman from Arkansas is chairman of the Natural Resources Committee, is a forester speaking in front of the House Ag Committee.
My home state has a wide array of agricultural commodities, and agriculture claims first place in the natural state's largest industry. While each segment of the industry is important to feed, fuel, and clothe Americans across the country, I'd like to talk to you about one specific sector. You can probably guess what that is. I'm proud to hold the title of the only licensed forester in Congress, and I enjoy talking about forestry and trees at any and every opportunity. I appreciate the work that the Agriculture Committee has done to address forestry issues, promote active forest management, and improve the health of our forest. As your committee continues the important work of crafting the Farm Bill, I want to share a few priorities with you that, in my opinion, will ensure the strongest and most comprehensive forestry title in the Farm Bill that is possible. I'm passionate about conserving our trees, as I know many of you are, and particularly when it comes to national treasures like our giant sequoias. As you know, nearly one-fifth of all giant sequoias were destroyed in the catastrophic wildfires in 2020 and 2021. That has prompted me to work closely with colleagues on both sides of the aisle to introduce the Save Our Sequoias Act. SOS provides a bipartisan and comprehensive response to address imminent threats facing the iconic giant sequoias. I believe this bill is bigger than just sequoias. Rather, it provides a framework for forest management bills that should come down the road. It's not every day that you see such powerful support on both sides of the aisle for a bill here in D.C., and I'm proud to be leading this legislation alongside my California colleagues. I'd like to highlight another important tool to improve forest health, and that's biochar. For those who may not be familiar with biochar, it's made by burning feedstock like low-value wood products or chicken litter or crop residues in the absence of oxygen. This process is known as pyrolysis. What's special about biochar, it is essentially a pure form of carbon. Biochar can sequester carbon for hundreds or even thousands of years. This ancient technique may be the solution to solving one of our most modern problems. Biochar can serve as a new market that can make removing low-value excess materials from our federal forest economical. Not only would this improve forest health, but biochar could then be used as a soil additive to retain moisture and nutrients and neutralize acidity. I plan to reintroduce bipartisan legislation shortly that will unleash this emerging technology to help it reach its full environmental and agricultural potential. This bill directs our federal land management agencies to establish biochar demonstration projects in each Forest Service and Bureau of Land Management region across the nation. I'm excited about the potential that biochar has to incentivize forest management and improve forest health, and I urge you to incorporate it into the Farm Bill. Another issue that I would like to see addressed in the Farm Bill is reversing the cottonwood decision. Cottonwood presents unnecessary, unworkable, and costly bureaucratic hurdles and empower environmental litigants with additional weapons to delay or cancel land and forest management projects. We need to provide a full, permanent fix to the misguided 2015 Cottonwood decision that has significantly hampered responsible forest management in many of our western states. We partially fixed this issue in the 2018 omnibus. However, that fix expired this March. I urge the Ag Committee to include the Forest Information Reform Act in the upcoming Farm Bill, which would resolve this issue fully and permanently.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
For those who produce and sell aquaculture products, per response to USDA's 2022 Census of Agriculture, they have opportunity to go into greater detail about their operations and in turn help shape their industry in the future.
The Census of Aquaculture is a very comprehensive process where we're actually getting information on the production of aquaculture, the sales method of production, the sources of water that are used for the facilities, point of first sales outlet, aquaculture distributed for restoration, conservation, or recreational purposes.
Travis Averill of the National Agricultural Statistics Service says Census of Aquaculture surveys will be mailed out starting December 18th, with response required by January 15th of 2024. Surveys can be returned by mail or online at www.agcounts.usda.gov. I'm Rod Bain reporting in Washington, D.C.